Why are you bringing up such painful memories? Still, I've just last year finally, you know, recovered shaking.
This was a street fight. People were scared of this movie, just like they were scared of Batman.
Tim is really, I gotta be honest, I think one of the only people who could really do it justice because he understands it. He's lived it. Man, he would have knocked it out of the park.
Tim was really gearing up for that, was really excited about it. So, you know, from that perspective, it was a big disappointment because I think he would have really stretched in a way that he hadn't yet. And maybe hasn't since, I don't know. He hasn't really made that movie.
Tim Burton's Superman would have been something quite unique. And probably something we'd still be talking about.
I always felt it was a missed opportunity, you know, because I think it would have been a really interesting movie with the way that Tim's take on it and with Nick playing Superman. I think it would have been awesome at that point in time.
Tim was not a comics geek. It is more of a let's take this apart, look at the fundamental roots of it, and let's build it back up.
I was always so excited by that footage. It's priceless.
It's fantastic. I was referring to this footage as the Holy Grail.
It is like the Holy Grail.
For anybody who thinks I'm insulting their Superman, I'll tell you something. He doesn't belong to you.
I always looked at Superman and said, can we get the diapers off of him a little bit?
If it's what you do for a living and you're excited about it yourself, the audience better be excited about it, right?
They just wanted us to go crazy. They just said, just draw monsters.
Now when you think about it, if somebody was like, would you like to see a Nick Cage Superman movie? I'd be like, and yes, take all my money because I want to see what that looks like.
Hello and welcome to The Complete Works, an in-depth look into the career and filmography of Nicolas Cage. My name is Mike Smith, and joining me on this journey into the depths of true cagedom is my friend, co-host, and fellow cageaholic,
Mike Tricuccio.
How are you doing today, Mike?
I am doing, you know, fine, I guess. You know.
I'll take it.
That's no good or bad, just right in the middle.
Completely indifferent. I love it.
yeah, you know, just the way you want to be when making something for public consumption.
Exactly. Now, Mike, we're shifting gears a little bit on the podcast today. Because we are talking about a movie that doesn't technically star Nicolas Cage.
Only if you go by the definition of starring.
but it is a movie that we felt, or at least I felt, would be sort of an oversight if we outright skipped it. You know what I mean? Like, I know.
Yeah.
I feel like at this point you're like, I just want to get this podcast done and over with.
I don't know if I'd go that far. But
when I was like, hey, we should do this extra thing too, you were like, I don't know.
Look, man, at this point, like, we're along for the ride. Let's just go all the way.
That's fair. Yeah, that's what I'm saying. So it's also the very first documentary to be featured on this podcast, too, so kind of a milestone there. The movie is called The Death of Superman Lives, What Happened? Now, we've referred to Superman Lives a few times on the show in the past, but for those who are unfamiliar, here's the backstory. In the mid-90s, Warner Brothers were trying really hard to get a new Superman movie off the ground after the success they had seen with the Batman movies. You gotta remember, this was back in the days when we weren't getting new superhero movies every month.
Right.
Right? The Dark Ages, as some might say. So that was, you know, the road to getting this movie made was a lot more difficult than I think it might have been today.
Yeah, that seems like an understatement.
Yeah. and the movie that they settled on went through a few writers, including most notably Kevin Smith. Was going to be directed by Tim Burton, and the reason we're bringing it up on this podcast is because it would have starred Nicolas Cage as Superman. Now, if you're wondering why this movie sounds unfamiliar to you, that's because this movie does not exist. it went to development hell after a couple of years, and then everyone involved went their separate ways, paving the way for Bryan Singer to make Superman Returns a few years later in 2006. But the legend of this unmade movie grew not only because of the talent involved, but because a lot of the story's elements were completely insane, and because a photo of Nicolas Cage dressed as Superman during a costume test eventually found its way online and became an instant meme. Like, before memes were even really a thing,
right?
This image of Nicolas Cage as Superman was there that we could all point to and be like, wow, I guess we dodged a bullet on that one. This documentary chronicles the behind-the-scenes journey of Superman Lives, featuring interviews from almost everybody involved with the production. The one major interview that they didn't get was Nicolas Cage.
Unfortunately.
And, yeah, that's a bummer, because I would be fascinated to know what Cage thinks of what they were going to do with this movie. Like, you know, having him reflect back on what this movie would have been, like, I think that would have been amazing.
Yeah, there's a few moments, you know, like some other archive footage or there's like one movie phone interview segment, yes, or something like that where he kind of talks about it. But it would have been nice to see him in his, you know, I don't know when this came out exactly.
2015.
2015. See him in 2015 reflecting back on what this could have been would have been much more interesting.
Yeah, definitely. Now, Cage, like you mentioned, does appear via archive footage. There's that movie phone interview. But most notably, it's the footage that was taken from a couple of different costume tests in 1997 and 1998. The tests where that image of him dressed as Superman came from originally. Now, the documentary was a passion project for filmmaker John Schnepp, who actually went to Kickstarter to get some of this movie funded.
Wow.
If you watch the credits, there's a lot of Kickstarter names that back this thing. Now, Schnepp was known at the time as a director, character designer, and voice actor on many Adult Swim shows, most notably Metalocalypse and Venture Brothers, which I know you were a big fan of, right, Mike?
Yeah. I didn't recognize that.
Yeah.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah, he was on Venture Brothers, and he actually passed away last summer after suffering a stroke, which is a bummer and unfortunate. Schnepp was also the host on a couple of different movie-related shows on Collider.com, including Movie Talk and Collider Heroes, where he developed a small fan base of movie geeks, and he hosted up until the time of his death this past summer. In addition to directing, Schnepp hosts the movie, and he provides an intro and is present for every single interview in the film. And even though he couldn't get Cage, the list of people he does get for this movie is pretty impressive. Of course, you've got Tim Burton and Kevin Smith. You've also got Dan Gilroy, who would later go on to direct Nightcrawler and Velvet Buzzsaw, who wrote the third draft of the Superman Lives script. Wesley Strick, who is the writer of Martin Scorsese's Cape Fear, Doom with The Rock, and one of the main writers on The Man in the High Castle on Amazon. He's in this movie. He wrote the second draft of the Superman Lives script. Producer John Peters, who would go on to produce Superman Returns and Man of Steel. Colleen Atwood, legendary costume designer, known for her work with Tim Burton. And Lorenzo de Bonaventura, best known for acting as producer of the Transformers franchise. Whenever you see him in this movie, he's got a shitload of Transformers merchandise.
Yeah.
Just sitting right behind him. Just so we know.
In case you forgot.
Exactly.
It's this guy.
Yep. So those are the big names involved, but Schnepp talks to everybody, from concept artists to production designers to comic book writers like Grant Morrison even. It's a pretty widespread of people in this movie. So The Death of Superman Lives, What Happened, was released on Video On Demand on July 9th, 2015, and if you weren't watching that, maybe you were headed to the theater because you could not wait to go see Minions.
You know what's sad? Somebody definitely was hyped to see Minions.
I think a lot of people were pretty hyped on Minions, Mike. It wasn't just somebody. It was a
big, you're not wrong.
It was a big hit. You could have also seen a very poorly reviewed horror movie called The Gallows, or a sci-fi thriller with Ben Kingsley and Ryan Reynolds, directed by Tarsem Singh, called Selfless, which I remember seeing trailers for, and I remember thinking it looked kind of interesting, and then I didn't see, and it got bad reviews. So take that for what you will.
Look at that.
I should also note that The Death of Superman Lives, What Happened, is not really available to stream anywhere anymore. It's not even available to rent, nor was I able to find a DVD copy of the movie through Netflix. And this just came out 3 years ago, which is kind of nuts. Luckily, the entire movie is actually available in full on John Schnepp's YouTube channel, which is how I watched it. And I would imagine maybe he just put it out there for free just because he could, I guess. So what are your overall thoughts on The Death of Superman Lives, Mike, now that we've kind of gone through all that, like the actual documentary?
I think this documentary is absolutely fascinating. Like you talked about, the amount of people that he gets to interview just really he's able to paint such a full picture of the development of this movie. You know, it's not just like about one specific thing or one aspect of it. You know, he's talking to all the concept artists and the special effects guys designing the suit and all right. that stuff. And there's so much archive footage that he gets access to, which is pretty crazy for just like some dude that wants to make a movie. Right. Like, and this is, you know, a big Hollywood legend, particularly like of the internet era, right? Like
yes.
1999. And this photo gets leaked and all this stuff, or not leaked, put online at least. So it's interesting that this isn't like some grand. Like, it's not some classical Hollywood thing that people would be eager to share about. Like, it's just some weird random thing that almost happened, and somehow he gets all these people to open up about it. And that's really cool to me. And I think particularly it's interesting for me because it only gets... It doesn't ever really make it past the production phase, like pre-production.
Yeah,
pre-production. Right? They didn't start filming or anything like that. So basically, all of this documentary takes place within the stuff you never really hear about, or at least I'm never super conscious about. Like, how many hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of pieces of concept art there are for movies,
right? Exactly.
Especially this one, I guess. All the suit design and how many the costume design and costume tests and like the whole process for all that stuff, figuring out materials and stuff like that. And it's really like just the weird, nerdy, deep, nitty gritty filmmaking stuff.
Yes.
And I really loved it. I thought it was really interesting and engaging, and it's a cool, crazy story. Like, the movie was going to be one, and what went on around it is a crazy story. So, like, yeah, I had a really fun time watching this.
Cool. Yeah, I had never seen this before, and I wanted to see it when it came out. Because I had been fascinated with Superman Lives for a very long time. Actually, my avatar on Twitter for years, like my very first avatar on Twitter up until like 2 years ago, was Nicolas Cage as Superman. Like,
that's right. Yeah, I remember that.
You know, and so I've been fascinated with Superman Lives for a very long time. I've always wondered what it could be like because, yeah, it's a Superman movie with Nicolas Cage as Superman, directed by Tim Burton, written by Kevin Smith. Like, that's so many insane names that like shouldn't go together, and it's like how would that even work? But I've always like felt like I would be fascinated just to see what that movie was like. I would say as a documentary, as this movie is, I feel like it kind of lives or dies based on how interested you are in Superman Lives.
Yeah, absolutely.
And for me, like, I'm very interested. Like, this is right up our alley. So it worked.
Yeah.
But I could see someone who had maybe never heard of it or wasn't like that into movies and stuff, like not really getting that much out of this movie, because as a documentary, I think it's like, as far as the filmmaking goes, it's fairly standard. You know, it's there's not much going on here. Like, I think all the interviews, like, you kind of just cut between interviews, and the anecdotes are great, and there's a lot of really interesting stuff that's happening, and all the concept art, like you mentioned. But I don't know, then you have like bits where it's like every single interview I noticed that John Schnepp is always on camera for, and I'm not sure he needed to be. You know, it's always one of those things where he's kind of just sitting there and he's always nodding. He's always nodding along.
Yes, I did notice that.
To whoever, like, after a while, it became like a, like, I wasn't drinking, but I could have been a drinking game for me while I watched this movie. You know, just every time he nods, take a drink, and you wouldn't make it for the movie, I don't think.
Yeah, it's really that kind of stands out to me a lot. That stands out to, you know, typically in documentary interviews, it's, you know, over the interviewer's shoulder or whatever, so you don't see the. But this, like, it seemed to ring, we only have enough for one camera, and maybe one guy is behind it, and right. I have to be sitting over here, because we can't get coverage or whatever. Some of it's really low light, some of it's, like, really grainy. You know, there's a couple, like, the stuff in Tim, the interviews with Tim Burton in his house, they're, like, in the dark. It's very weird. The sound quality's not great. But, like, it speaks to it just being, like, this weird passion project for people that are just interested in this specific story.
Yes. Yeah, I would agree. I think it is clearly a labor of love. Like, they really wanted to make this movie. And I think it's part of its charm. But it also doesn't have, like, the production value of something like Jodorowsky's Dune, for example, which is a very similar movie, because it's a movie about the Dune movie that Alejandro Jodorowsky never made, right? And it's all about that that concept art and the design and everything. Or Lost in La Mancha, which is the documentary about the man who killed Don Quixote, and that movie that never got made, which actually has been made now, is actually coming out. It's insane. We'll see. Fingers crossed that it comes out.
Yeah.
But yeah, so I think, you know, those movies have higher production values, but this one, it clearly has a lot of passion behind it. But I also, like, couldn't shake the feeling that, like, as a movie on its own, I'm not sure it is, like, a movie. But it would be a great bonus feature on a DVD. You know what I mean? Like,
yes.
Like, if this was, like, an hour-long special package within a Blu-ray set of Superman movies, like, that, I feel like that would be the ideal place for it.
Yeah, absolutely. I could definitely see, like, you know, it's only available on YouTube right now, basically.
Yes.
And, like, I kind of see why.
yeah, definitely. But I think, you know, most of the interviews are really interesting, especially Kevin Smith and especially Tim Burton and John Peters. Like, they give you, well, the John Peters one we'll get to in a little bit, but that guy's insane. you know, it gives you a lot of insight, you know, not just into this movie, but, you know, like you were saying, into all of the creative processes of Hollywood as a whole, and some of the anecdotes that are told, like, they're just, you know, it's a lot of those things that you never hear about. Or it's stuff that, like, you always assume happens, and then you realize, like, all this stuff happens on, like, every movie that gets made.
You know? Yeah, like, I don't understand. Like, when you, like, you watch this movie, this documentary, and you kind of, like, try to conceptualize how many movies are being made at one time. What are these, like, are these people just, like, locked away for 2 years making this movie? Like, I don't are they working on multiple movies? Like, how does this how does any of this work?
Exactly.
How is someone able to spin this many plates and have it maybe work? And then forget it after 2 years. Never mind.
Yeah.
Like, what? That's crazy.
Yeah. Like, that's, and honestly, in some cases, that's, like, the best case scenario. What if the movie comes out and it's terrible and you spent, like, 2 or 3 years of your life, you know, putting all this stuff together for it, you know?
Yeah.
There's, you know, it's a thankless business a lot of the time. And this movie, I think, gets to the heart of that. And the thing is, and I will say, you know, I thought all the interviews were really cool. I thought, like, a lot of those were, like, really interesting gets, and, like, there's a lot of great stories. But without an actual interview from Nicolas Cage, like, the movie feels a little bit incomplete to me.
Yeah.
You know?
It's definitely noticeable.
Like, and they don't even, like, mention the fact that they don't get to talk to Nicolas Cage, right? Like, everybody's talking about Nicolas Cage. Like, everybody's saying, like, oh, yeah, so Nicolas Cage did this, Nicolas Cage did this. But, like, you never get to, like, talk to Nicolas Cage and get his side of, like, where things were. Like, because I would love to hear about, you know, like, if he could go in-depth about, like, everything, his experience with this movie. And, you know, you don't get that in this movie. And that's, it feels like just a huge gap in what this movie's able to offer. Otherwise, it's great. Like, I really enjoyed every other interview in this movie. It just feels like it's missing something.
Yeah, there's one moment in particular towards the end where it's, like, voiceover from Nicolas Cage, where it seems like it's going to be a Nicolas Cage. Like, I forget exactly what he's saying, but it sort of presents itself as if they're talking to him. It's,
yes.
You know, he's talking over, like, the archive footage of the costume tests and stuff. And then it goes, like, it finishes whatever point he's making and it goes away. And it's like, oh, wait, no, that's from somewhere else. Like,
exactly, yep.
It seems like it's going to be Nicolas Cage on screen in just a minute.
You know, that character is such a bullseye that you have to hit. He's almost, you know, he's one of the most precious icons of our country. And the fact that Tim and I were pretty far down the road designing it, and I know with Tim and where I was going to go, we would have done something really special. At least it's out there in the ether that could have happened, but it doesn't have to, we don't have to make the movie. It's still interesting to people.
And I think it is noticeable. And it might be because, you know, we're watching it through the lens of Nicolas Cage, right? We're kind of going in there for him.
Sure. Well, he was going to be the star of the movie. You know,
oh, absolutely.
And he was cast. Like, he had the costume test and everything. Like, I would love to just hear about what he thought of Superman Lives, you know? But I should ask you, I mean, do you think Superman Lives would have been a good movie? After you watch this whole documentary, like, do you think Superman Lives would have worked as a movie?
You know, I don't really know. I feel like there's the moment they talk about it right before they get the plug gets pulled on the movie, on the production and everything, where they come back, you know, they get notes from the studio or whatever. We're like, yeah, we ran a budget and it's too high. You have to start cutting stuff. And they're like, yeah, we changed all the locations to just take place in this tomb for the resurrection,
right,
and all this, like, weird stuff. You could see that the beginning of, like, the studio meddling was, if it got made, it would have been heavily changed by the studio at that point. You know, once the blank check went away and they're like, no, actually, you have X number of dollars, make it fit. then it would have been, I feel like it might have ended up just being like this weird mess made by studios. But, you know, I feel like I haven't rewatched any of those Batman movies from the 90s in a long time.
Mm.
And my memory is they kind of are like that. They're just like totally bonkers. It seems like maybe the studio is involved. I don't know. But it is, I think it's crazy to think about. You know, there was basically no superhero movie between the Superman movies and then Batman in 1989 or whatever.
Yeah.
And kind of kickstarted that whole movement,
which we're now deep into. Yeah. I mean, and even that, like, you know, I guess kickstarted it, sure, but, like, even throughout the 90s, like, it was mostly just the Batman movies.
That's true.
You know, there was the Batmans, and then there was, like, a lot of, like, offshoots and, like, attempts at superhero movies, right? Like, there was the Phantom, and there was Steel, and there was Blade. Oh, Blade was actually, that one worked.
Yeah, but I mean, like, that's the kind of movie we're getting.
Sure,
Spawn,
yeah.
And, like,
Spawn,
that kind of weird shit.
Definitely, yeah. But, like, Blade, I think, did more for the modern era of superhero movies than Tim Burton's Batman did. Just cause,
yeah, that's fair.
Just because, like, Blade, I mean, Blade A proved that you can do an R-rated superhero movie and be successful back in the late 90s, which it took studios a very long time to figure out that lesson.
Yeah, to accept.
but then, like, 2 years after Blade, you have X-Men coming out. And then once you have X-Men, you have Spider-Man. And then, like, the X-Men and Spider-Man franchises are rolling. And then there's still, like, you know, stuff that doesn't work, like Hulk and Daredevil and Ghost Rider and everything. But, like, the wheels had kind of gone in motion around the time Blade and X-Men really kicked off. And Superman Lives was, like, just before that. Blade came out in 98.
This would have been part of that.
This could have been part of that. You know, it would have been big. I think if this movie had come out. Plus, I mean, it was also, you gotta remember, this was, during peak action hero Nicolas Cage that this movie was being made, too. That was,
yeah, wasn't this the We Made It My Trilogy era?
We Made It My Trilogy, it was 96 and 97, The Rock, Con Air, and Face Off. Like, the costume test for this movie is in 97, so, like, this would have been part of, like, that could have been a quadrilogy, the We Made It My Quadrilogy.
Oh, man, you know, what a future that would have been.
Superman could have used his heat vision on a beige Volvo, and would have been great.
Yeah.
Now, you know, normally I ask you, what did you think of Nicolas Cage in this movie, Mike? And I can't really do that because he's not really in it. But how do you think Nicolas Cage would have fit into the role of Superman?
I think it would have been really fucking cool. Like, you know, I don't have a huge attachment to the character per se, but there is they do talk about through a lot of the interviews, they wanted someone that wasn't going to have the S-curl, the hair, didn't have a square jaw.
Sort of like the polar opposite of Christopher Reeve, basically.
Right. But then they also show, what's his name, Brandon Routh, right?
Brandon Routh, yeah, for Superman.
Routh, yeah, and Mustache Man, wow, I can't believe I forget
his
name.
Henry Cavill.
But, like, they all kind of sort of look the same, and Nick Cage is so different from that, and I think it would have been a very interesting choice, with the long hair or whatever. Which is pretty funny, I think.
Yeah, I mean, that's something that the long hair some people made fun of when the image hit, but they mentioned it in the movie that you gotta remember, at the time, Superman in the comics had long hair. That's what they were modeling it after.
And I think, but with that arc, in those costume test footage, you kind of see him, Nick Cage, and Burton kind of like riffing a little bit. Like, what's the significance of this cape? And, like, you know, they're like, oh, this is my father's cape, and it's a long line of Kryptonians and all this stuff. And I think, like, that would have been really cool. It's interesting to see, like, the very early process of Nicolas Cage developing a character, which we never really get to see.
Exactly.
Particularly, in peak Cage era. Now it's probably he just shows up and does whatever and just goes home. But at this point, you know, he's leading Man Cage, and that's awesome.
That's kind of neat. It kind of has, like, all the... It's like a child's blanket.
We know we're doing a fairy tale.
Yeah.
I think you want to see this in its entirety
without it going into.
Did you design the S thing?
Well, we kind of took it off from the more modern ones where it's a little just sleeker. Well, that's the whole thing. We would make it reminiscent of whatever we see on Krypton. That's the whole thing.
My father wore this cape.
This cape was handed down to me.
Exactly.
This cape was from a long line of Kryptonians who were at the top of the field in science and law
and performing arts.
I was thinking about when we left after our last meeting, Clark Kent in that T-shirt.
You had an idea, which this now, seeing you like this, the kind of mismatched kind of... Remember we were talking about more wilder?
Well, we were talking about having, like, a Mickey Mouse t-shirt.
I was hearing other people making jokes.
You guys are the best.
It's a combination of playing a Hunnite and also... Superman.
Look good in mini Hunnits on your day.
Superman and Super Freak.
Nobody would think this is Superman.
Yeah. You're also dressing like one of these guys at these science fiction conventions.
It's just Cage kind of riffing with Tim Burton, which, by the way, it's 90s Tim Burton, which looks so different than, like, present-day Tim Burton.
Yeah, I know. It's great.
Which was cool, and, like, Colleen Atwood's also there, and they're kind of talking about what the costume means and, like, what they're going to be doing, and they're talking about his interpretation of what Clark Kent's going to be versus what Superman's going to be, and he was going to play Clark Kent kind of, like, as this, like, disheveled mess
I really loved that, actually.
I think that was a cool idea, where, like, you know, he's, like, Cage says something along the lines of, like, yeah, because he's hearing, you know, somebody crack a joke, like, a mile away, and you're just like...
Yeah.
You know, I picture sort of, like what Mark Ruffalo is doing in Thor Ragnarok, when he turns into Bruce Banner from the Hulk.
Just doing Woody Allen.
And he's just doing Woody Allen. He's so disoriented and, like, just confused about the world around him. Like, that... I feel like that's sort of what Cage is gonna go for with his Clark Kent. I think that could have been really cool.
Yeah.
You know, I think it just would have been really interesting. They talk about it as if it would be, like, this deconstructionist take on Superman, which is sort of the direction they went in for Man of Steel. Like, they kind of took it as, like, you know, this darker route and everything.
Right.
But, like, that didn't really work in that movie. But I think that's partially because this was meant to be, like, the launch of a whole cinematic universe. But this would have been, like, probably, like, a one-off. After you've gotten, like, four movies with Christopher Reeve, who was, like, the golden boy. Like, this could have been, like, a really cool, like, alternate version. That you hadn't seen before.
Yeah, and I think, that one scene in particular, one moment where he's like, you know, I was just imagine him asking Lois Lane to, like, the Journalist of the Year award dinner, and she says no, like, because he's just such, like, a schmo.
Yeah.
And he's wearing the Mickey Mouse t-shirt. I thought, yeah, like, I loved that stuff. I thought that would have been awesome.
Yes, definitely. And if he didn't like the long hair, I mean, the next costume test had him with the shorter hair, and he looked more like a traditional Superman, I thought. Just it happened to be Nicolas Cage. So, yeah, I think he could have been, like, a really cool Superman. Plus, I mean, you know, Nicolas Cage is, like, a huge comics guy. Like, he's been a fan of Superman his entire life. Like, you can see it, like, in his face, like, just how kind of excited he is when he's doing the costume test.
Yeah, you can tell he's pumped.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, he's, like, working through it, and he's talking about it, how he's, you know... He's excited to do it, but he's also not so, like, beholden to the character that he won't, like, allow for changes and stuff. It's not a static thing for him. And so, you know, when they try on the costume for the first time, like, he's like, yeah, this doesn't feel right. Like, it's weird and rubbery, and, like, his arms couldn't move, I think, was, like, one of the things. And so you kind of see, like, the process go on and on about, and eventually you get to a costume that, like, is physically works, and he can move around in it, and it looks good, and it's like, hey, this could have been really something, you know?
Yeah, and I love all the stuff they get into, particularly with the props guys, like the guys that were making the suit, and like how they came up with to make it like opalescent, and like the fiber optic cable lights and stuff that they could program like a neon sign and like all this stuff that would have been so fucking dope.
Yeah,
taking this like weird. You know, they reference like Geiger and Mobius and like this sort of like biomechanical thing they were going to go for.
Yes.
I thought that shit would have been awesome. It might have looked like trash because it's 90s. Like, you know, I don't know what it might have ended up looking like.
Yeah.
But if they went for it and it worked, I think it could have been really dope.
Definitely. Now, this role, I mean, I usually ask you, how does this role fit into the roles that we've seen Cage play so far? But obviously he didn't actually play this role. But I mean, how do you think this fits into in terms of his entire career that we've covered so far, and maybe even in the future, you know, how do you think this fits into Cage's career?
Like, what this would have been?
Yeah, what this would have been. Like, imagine the what-if scenario where this movie came out in 98. Like, how would this fit into Cage's filmography?
I think if it works, like, if it was successful, right, I think it would have made the We Made It Ma quadrilogy, like you said. I think it might have propelled him further into action leading man. I mean, it kind of lasts for a while, though, right? Like, he's still that kind of role, like, in National Treasure and stuff like that.
Yeah, definitely.
So I don't know if it would have prolonged it, maybe. I don't know. I think it would have been interesting. It would have maybe kept him, like, in that top level longer. I'm not really sure. I don't know. What do you think?
It might have kept him more in the public consciousness.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, like, he was still a major star for a very long time after that, but, like, I don't know. When you play a superhero, like, there's something about that where people will always refer back to you from that point on. You know, like, with Batman, like, everybody knows, like, okay, yeah, Michael Keaton was Batman, right? And that kind of thing. Like, so no matter what Michael Keaton does, like, he was Batman, you know?
Right. Yeah.
And so I could see that being a thing where, like, yeah, Nicolas Cage played Superman, so, like, in a way, he's always going to be defined by the fact that he played Superman, at least partially, in the eyes of the public, because that's going to be a movie that a lot of people see, and that is a character who's important to a lot of people. And so I think that could definitely be a part of it. And this would have been the first time that Nicolas Cage played a superhero, which he would, of course, go on to play in several other movies, like Ghost Rider 1 and 2, Kick-Ass, Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse, and in a cameo that brought it all full circle, Teen Titans Go to the Movies, where he plays Superman.
That's true.
You know, was a direct reference to Superman Lives. But I'm curious, like, if any of those roles would have happened if he had been able to actually play Superman. Like, do you think he would have played Ghost Rider if he had played Superman before that? That feels like it would have been a step down, you know?
I don't know about Ghost Rider. I definitely feel like Big Daddy, though, from Kick-Ass, because that feels like it could be a reference, like a riff, like a joke.
That's true. And that's more of a Cage-type role as opposed to a superhero-type role.
Yeah, and it's more Batman, you know, or like inspired by Batman.
Yeah,
it's like
definitely.
It could have been a joke that he's doing that. So I can see that Ghost Rider would have been real weird.
Yeah, like that's like because Ghost Rider was like his big superhero movie, right? That was the thing.
Yeah,
but like you know, you go from Superman to Ghost Rider, like that's a step down.
Like there's to no Marvel Knights.
Yeah, to Marvel Knights. Yeah, and yeah, I think you know we did talk about this as like kind of sort of the next chapter in the We Made It My trilogy, if it had come to pass. I think that's I think you know if Cage had played Superman. In real life, like if that movie had actually been made, I think this podcast would look a lot different. Like,
oh yeah,
I think it would have affected his entire career. He would have like maybe he would have made some Superman sequels.
I'm sure. If know, it worked, there would have been more.
If it worked and if it was a big hit, I'm sure. Like, especially because around that time, that was like you know around the time the comic book movie started happening and you started getting locked into contracts and stuff like that. I mean, honestly, like, if that movie had worked and it had been made. The entire comic book movie industry might be completely different than what it is today, you know? Especially because, I mean, one of the things that was pointed out in this movie is that Kevin Smith's original script, and I don't know if this carried over to the other drafts, but it sort of had that shared universe thing going on in that script. He mentions at the end that, like, Batman shows up at Superman's funeral and that kind of thing, and Deadshot's in it. And, like, so the shared universe thing would have happened in 98. You know, ten years before Marvel got to it. So the entire, like, if DC had gotten to that concept first and it had worked, I don't think we'd be seeing Avengers Endgame in, like, a couple of weeks, you know? Like, or if we were, it would be a very different movie, you know?
Right. It might be the culmination of a 20-movie Justice League journey.
Yeah. It's totally, like, honestly, like, what if that had happened, right? Like that's sort of the like this is a what if question that raises more what if questions. Like if this movie had happened, would the superhero boom had happened faster? Would it have like been delayed because everybody was trying to imitate this weird ass Superman movie that
this art film?
This weird like Geiger influenced Superman art film that had like all these insane concepts going for it and like didn't realize that was like a lightning in a bottle thing and it could only happen once. And like, I don't know, like, you know, would people have burned out in superhero movies more quickly? Like, who knows? So there's a lot going on when you analyze Superman Lives, just like how different the world of movies would be today. If this movie had been made.
Yeah. Especially because like, you know, you're sort of talking about just that superhero movies just dominate everything now. Like that's the whole conversation.
Yeah.
As far as like tentpole blockbuster summer movies. Right.
Yeah.
And, if this had kickstarted that, a couple years earlier or killed it, like if it didn't work, would it have not had happened anyway?
Right.
But I don't know, because I guess X-Men and Spider-Man were like right around the corner, so they might have happened regardless. But
sure.
I don't know.
But I mean, think about it this way, too. The reason Batman Begins came out is because DC had nothing going on, right? Like
that's true, yeah, yeah.
And so if Superman Lives had come out and been a hit, DC might not have seen the need to make a new Batman movie at all because Batman and Robin had just bombed, and they could have and they could have ridden the Superman franchise for like another 10 years before they had to do anything else. You know,
yeah, that's a good point.
And so if Batman Begins never come out, you know, you don't get the Dark Knight, you don't get you know Heath Ledger winning an Oscar, you don't get the wave of dark and gritty reboots that happened in the mid 2000s and the 2010s, which were like largely terrible anyway. So it's fine, but like
yeah.
But then you don't have that counterbalance, and you don't have the DC universe kind of taking its cues from the Dark Knight, right? You know, so
yeah.
You know everything has consequences, and when you take away this like one event, like if you change one thing, it's the butterfly effect, right? It's the it's what Ashton Kutcher warned us about.
If only we had listened.
If only. So yeah, like the DC, like if Superman Lives had come out in '98. I think the DC universe, at least just the DC universe, would look entirely different than what it does now.
Yeah. If John Peters hadn't been so fucking weird, Which, you know, like, it's so interesting, too. The, you know, documentaries typically have some kind of, like, story they're telling. Even though this one usually, like, for the most part, avoids that.
Yeah.
It kind of just blames John Peters in some weird way.
By the end of it, yes, it becomes, like, everybody kind of is like, yeah, no, John Peters was the like, thing that really held this movie back. Yeah. Except for John Peters, of course, he's the one who doesn't seem to think so.
I don't know if you've heard this, Mike, but he's been in over 500 fights.
Yeah, I think he said something like, I've tasted another man's blood or something like that at one point.
Yeah.
It was like, Jesus.
Yeah.
If you're not familiar with John Peters, they give a little bit of his backstory in the movie, and he's a former hairdresser that ended up dating Barbara Streisand. He was Barbara Streisand's hairdresser, and then they ended up dating, and through his relationship with Barbara Streisand, he became like a well-known Hollywood producer. And that's, such an insane story on its own. And then you actually get to talk to John Peters, and it's like, oh, no, he's actually insane also.
It's just a real American dream story.
Yeah.
It's bizarre.
Yeah, a boy starts out from nothing, and he's insane, and he becomes
rich, and he's
insane.
Yes, exactly.
Now, what are the moments or scenes in The Death of Superman Lives that stood out to you, Mike? I mean, what interviews that popped out to you and that kind of thing?
I think the Tim Burton interviews are particularly interesting. I'm not someone, like, you know, I'm a big fan of Tim Burton's movies, but I don't know, you know, I don't know much of his story, and I don't, like, see things with him in it, like Tim Burton himself talking about movies and stuff. So, like, just to get a glimpse of what his mind is like and what he's like in this kind of very early phase of, you know, drawing stick figure sketches and being like, make this happen, and, like, people being able to do it because he's so evocative and stuff.
Right.
Was really cool, and just his house is super weird and exactly what you would expect.
Yeah, when you first show up at Tim Burton's estate, you know, Schnepp's walking through, and it's cut into, like, different memorabilia from, like, Mars Attacks and Beetlejuice and things like that. And then you meet Tim Burton, and he's wearing sunglasses in a dark room surrounded by Halloween decorations.
And it's like, sitting in front of, like, a ventriloquist doll.
Exactly. And it's like, this is the most Tim Burton that Tim Burton has ever been.
Yeah. I love the, like, sort of introduction, right? It's like Tim Burton, like the Burton estate, and it's like a view of, like, a landscape kind of thing, and it, like, pans down to, like, some headstones. It's like, yeah, of course.
Yeah, that sounds about right. But yeah, no, I found that pretty fascinating too. And I'm somebody who, you know, Tim Burton is a filmmaker who I really love most of his early stuff, I think. And Ed Wood, one of the greatest movies ever made. I love that movie so much. And, like, Pee-wee's Big Adventure, Beetlejuice, his Batman movies, like, yeah, I'm all about that. I think, honestly, post-Superman Lives, I feel like there is a distinct change in his work where it becomes, like, more, I don't know, like, it tries too hard to be a Tim Burton thing a lot of the time, you know what I mean?
Right.
It becomes very Hot Topic. I think it's how I've described Tim Burton in the past, where it's like, this is just trying to sell sweatshirts to kids at Hot Topic. And
it becomes about the style.
It becomes much more about the style and less about the actual storytelling. And he's made good movies since. Like, I think Big Fish is amazing. I kind of like Big Eyes. I thought Big Eyes was solid. His Frankenweenie, Sweeney Todd, I like those. But then you have, you know, his Planet of the Apes remake, and you have Alice in Wonderland, and you have, what was the other movie he made? Dark Shadows. Dark Shadows was terrible.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
And he's coming out with a new movie in a few weeks, actually, his remake of Dumbo.
That's right.
I'm very curious how that movie's going to go. I think it looks better than Alice in Wonderland did. But like, this is a very low bar to clear, so we'll see.
Yeah.
But I did like just, like, getting to see Tim Burton talk about this movie and how much work he put into it. Because you see all these sketches that he did, and, like, you know, I think somebody at one point mentions, like, yeah, we started calling him Edward Supermans. Because his sketches look so, like, his sketches are so exactly what you would picture a Tim Burton sketch to look like.
Mm-hmm.
Right? They look like the characters from Nightmare Before Christmas. Essentially. And so to see that side of Tim Burton, I thought was pretty cool. I think for me, the absolute highlight of the movie is Kevin Smith.
Yeah, that was my second one, I was going to say.
Like, I mean, I have loved Kevin Smith since I was a teenager. And he's sort of a similar situation where, like, you know, so much of his early stuff is so ingrained in my soul. I mean, Clerks, one of my favorite movies of all time. I've talked many times about how much I love Mallrats. I was just talking about Mallrats in the Captain Marvel episode, film book right. actually. But then you get to his later stuff, like his more recent stuff, like Yoga Hosers and Tusk, and I was like, yeah, and I'm not as big on it. But I could listen to him talk about comic books and movies for like 6 hours.
Oh, yeah. Well, there's a very funny moment. You know, like you said, yeah, he is an incredible speaker, right? Like,
yes.
You can tell an amazing story. And there's a moment where he talks about, after he suggests Tim Burton be the director, and he gets fired because Tim Burton's got his own guy,
yes,
which is hilarious. He's like, you know, I sort of realized that, I forget exactly the wording, but he's like, my career changed where, you know, I realized the point of my career wasn't going to be writing Superman, it was going to be talking about writing Superman. And I was like, yeah. Like,
yeah,
honestly, he's got all these speaking tours and specials and stuff.
Yeah, and he had at one point he hosted like 15 podcasts or something. Like,
yeah. And I feel like just because of that, that kind of kept the legend of this movie alive, where Kevin Smith would bring it up all the time in his interviews and stuff like that. And one of the other things I will definitely applaud John Schnepp on, maybe it's not particularly that he's a great interviewer or anything like that, but just like everyone is so candid about everything.
Yes.
No one kind of dodges any real questions except John Peters because he's a weirdo. but everyone kind of like tells the story. Like no one really.
Yeah.
No one shies away from what was going on, which I thought was pretty cool.
Yeah. I would also say John Peters isn't really dodging the questions either. He's just insane. That's my.
that's fair. Yeah, yeah.
That's my general thought. But yeah, when Kevin Smith was talking, like when he first showed up, and like really, Kevin Smith is really mostly in the first half hour of this movie or so, and then like after that point, like his script gets changed out, Wesley's script takes over, and so it's like, okay, so Kevin Smith does show up in the movie periodically, but he's really most heavily in the first half hour. So when he's talking about like first getting on the set and like just talking to John Peters about it, and he tells you the three rules that John Peters laid out for him when writing the script, which was amazing. A, the first rule, Superman can't fly. And Kevin Smith's like, really? Superman can't fly? And then this rule number two, Superman can't wear his iconic suit. Now, John Peters, when he was interviewed, denied that he had those two rules. But Kevin Smith was pretty adamant about it. So, I tend to believe Kevin Smith because John Peters, again, is insane. Then the third rule, which John Peters did not deny, is that Superman had to fight a giant spider in the third act.
Which I love. That's amazing.
Yes, I love that. And, you know, yeah, so Peter said he never told him to do the first two, but then, yes, the giant spider was always a part of the production. And then the payoff at the end of the documentary, in which it's revealed that when WB shut down production Superman Lives, they put all the money into Wild Wild West with Will Smith, which John Peters was also a producer on. And then you got to Kevin Smith telling the story of seeing Wild Wild West, seeing Kenneth Branagh emerge in a giant metal spider, and then seeing John Peters' name in the credits and being like, that motherfucker finally got his spider. hilarious. Like, that was such a great payoff to that whole bit.
Yeah. And it's like the last thing that's in the movie.
Yes.
It's pretty great.
And then Peter's like, yeah, I put the spider in Wild Wild West. What are you gonna do? Didn't deny it. It was great.
The Thanagarian snare beast, which I love.
Yes. Just
that phrase, like, somebody needs to make, like, a garage punk band, and that's the name.
Oh, my God. I would be amazed if that doesn't exist already.
Like, it must, right? Come on.
But yeah, they had to get away from calling it a spider, so they called it a Thanagarian snare beast. And they were like, yeah, fine. It's a spider, but we don't have to call it that. So, yeah, that was pretty great. I was a big fan of that. The doc does establish John Peters as a bad guy. And I think hearing the stories about John Peters, like, towards the end of the movie, I think were really fascinating. I think Tim Burton says that at one point, John Peters, like, kissed him full on the lips for no reason.
Yeah.
Which was weird. And then one guy, Rick Heinrich, starts talking about how John Peters put him in a headlock at one point because they were having, like, disagreements over, like, the concept art.
Yeah. You know? Yeah, super weird. Like, he's definitely one of those guys that probably should get a Me Too coming up. and it kind of just they talk about that where he would like bring people to tour the office or whatever and then like wrestle the artists
He would bring like kids to the office. Like he talked about how he'd bring like a bunch of like 10-year-old kids because they would give him like the real answers that the adults won't give him or something.
Yeah.
It's like come on, man, you're insane.
Like stop being such a dick.
But I did love that like Tim Burton was like genuinely, it seemed like he was genuinely upset he never got to make this movie.
Yeah, yeah, and it's interesting too. You think about like, you know, almost all of Tim Burton's movies are about this like ostracized other,
the outsider kind of thing.
And that, like that is Superman. Then there's really interesting. I forget who it is exactly. It might be Tim Burton actually, who says, you know, like Batman is from Earth and Spider-Man is from Earth. The X-Men are from Earth. They're mutants, but they're from Earth.
Yes.
Superman is like a literal alien. And like the most other you can get as far as humanity is concerned. And like that would have, it seemed like Burton poured a lot of himself and heart into what he was, his interpretation of that character was going to be.
Yeah.
And it seems like he might not, like, he didn't really recover. I don't know. It's kind of sad.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, even at the end of the movie, like, you know, Schnepp asks him, like, you know, what would you want to do it all over again if you could make this movie? And Burton kind of gives him, like, this grimace and is like, you know, I'm going to be 90 one day and I'll be like, I'm still going to make it. Like, so yeah, I thought that was really interesting. But, yeah. And there's also one moment in the movie, I wanted to get your take on this, where, John Peters takes a phone call in the middle of the interview.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think most documentaries would cut that part out. But Schnepp left it in and I was curious, like, I guess cause he thought it was funny and like, it is pretty funny. It's also very awkward.
Yeah.
It's just happening and it's just there. So what did you think of that moment? Like what was your read on that?
It felt to me a lot like, It's left in because, one, it is funny, and, you know, Schnepp is just, like, weirdly drinking water.
Yes.
I don't know, like, like that felt like a comedic bit.
Yeah.
But it also, it serves to sort of, like, the further the narrative that Peters is crazy. Because, like, I don't remember exactly when, this happens. If it's after the moment where he's like, yeah, you know, I wanted them to, you know, talking about wrestling the people. And he's like, I wanted them to know what it's like to break your hands on someone else's nose and taste someone else's blood. And it's like,
right.
What the fuck are you talking about? Oh, yeah, go ahead. Just take a phone call, man. It's fine.
Yeah.
Like, it sort of just serves to further that narrative that he's crazy. Even though I think it sort of goes to lengths, too. Or at least Lorenzo Di whatever.
Bonaventura.
Bonaventura, there we go. He kind of goes through, he kind of gives like a studio executive, because he sort of was one, kind of breakdown of what went wrong in terms of, like, the business and money side, which seems probably to have a larger effect than John Peters' influence. But
yes, definitely.
The movie still sets up John Peters as, like, this villain sort of force.
Yeah, definitely. But yeah, you're right. Now, they do kind of break down, like, the actual financial side of things and the year that Warner Brothers was having at that time, and Batman and Robin had just bombed. And it kind of describes the whole boardroom where they have, like, a calendar taking up the entire wall with every movie they're releasing in that year and seeing, like, how much money they're making. And it's just, like, an entire year of bombs for Warner Brothers, and that was, like, a real reason why that's, like, the real reason Superman Lives was canceled, because they couldn't.
Yeah.
Like, because they had lost too much money, they couldn't spend enough to make it. It wasn't a guaranteed hit because it was going to be a weird Superman movie, you know, and that kind of thing. And so ultimately they spent about like $10 to $12 million on the pre-production for this movie, and that's about the only amount. That's the amount of money they sunk into it. They were saying that like a lot of people probably weren't even paid for their work on this movie, which is insane.
Yeah.
Because they kind of speculated on that. They didn't know, but like they were saying like Tim Burton or Nicolas Cage might have had like pay or play contracts. So you have to make the movie in order to get paid kind of thing. That's the idea behind those. So yeah, there's some interesting stuff there. I also wanted to mention another insane story about John Peters from Dan Gilroy, the third screenwriter of the movie, where he talks about writing the script and writing the scene where Superman dies. Because this movie, I don't know if you mentioned, is based on the Death of Superman comic book storyline, which ended up being incorporated into Batman vs. Superman Dawn of Justice.
Yes.
But, you know, so he was writing the scene where Superman dies. And he's talking and he's like, yeah. So I remember writing the scene where Superman dies. And as I was writing it, I heard on the news that Princess Diana had just died. Like, as he was writing that scene, Princess Diana died. And when that happened, John Peters called him up and told him to get down here to watch the funeral so that he could take notes on how to write the funeral for the movie.
That was crazy, but it felt like such a weird, like, good idea, right? Like, I don't understand.
I get it. It just seems like such a callous thing to
yes.
To
yeah,
say.
Oh, absolutely.
But I get it, because, yeah, I mean, the idea is that if Superman dies, like, everybody's going to be coming out for it. It's going to be this huge event and everything. So I would get that. But it's such a weird story. Like, it's just a weird anecdote, you know? It's not a crazy John Peters story, essentially.
Yeah, to be like, write this now, like, while, like, write the thing about this beloved public icon that just died. Just do that. I'm like, what?
Yes.
And I love my favorite weird John Peters anecdote. Right? He insists that Brainiac's ship, right? Which we haven't even gotten to the plot of this movie because it's too complicated really to explain.
Well, but I feel like the plot of this movie changed so much over the course of the different screenplay drafts.
Yeah.
They keep mentioning, like, oh, and yeah, so we're going to have Brainiac fuse with Lex Luthor, and also there's going to be a ninja fight, and also...
That's great.
And also there's, like, polar bears that are guarding the Fortress of Solitude that Brainiac has to kill, and it's like a lot of that stuff would have been cut out of the movie, I think, by the time the end product comes along.
Brainiac, right? He escaped Krypton or whatever, and he's got this skull-shaped ship that was supposed to be based on, like, Lucy in the Ice or whatever, like that famous...
Oh, yeah, the fossil.
Right. Yeah, like a fossil, yeah. And he's got all of his you know, monsters that he's collected in it and stuff like that, and he makes, you know, the production team or whatever, the visual effects guys, like, make a clay model of it.
Yeah.
And he calls them up and is like, yeah, I need this for to go give a presentation with. I want to show it to, like, the board or, you know, whatever, whoever he's pitching this like, update to. And then the next day, the movie got canceled, and he disappeared with the model. And then and then Schnepp finds it in his house. Like, right. It's on display in his house. And he, like, turns and looks to the camera, and he's like, hey, like, dude, I found the skull ship. Oh, my God, what?
Yes. Yeah, that was amazing. So the moral of the story is that John Peters is insane. And yeah, other stuff I wanted to just briefly bring up. I did want to mention how much it must have sucked, but there's that one concept designer, I think his name was Sylvain, who did a lot of drawings for the movie, and he kind of came in with this very European influence. Right. But he mentions that, like, when he was hired on this movie, like, he had just been hired to work on The Matrix, and he quit to work on Superman Lives. and I heard that, and I was like, oh, no!
Poor boy.
So that was that's just one of those things where it's like, man, like, there's so many stories like that and that you don't hear about, where, like, somebody, like, just missed out on this job because they tried this other job that they thought sounded better and ended up being terrible, and, like, the job they passed on ended up being, like, the big hit movie. And you hear that and it's like, man, I'm not sure this guy was fine. Like, he seemed like he's, you know, still working and everything, but, like, you could have worked in The Matrix, man.
Yeah, I mean, like, who would think this weird cerebral, like, Kung Fu Keanu Reeves sci-fi movie would be the one to make it instead of the Tim Burton Nicolas Cage Superman movie
right.
in 1998. Like, what?
Like, one of the biggest directors at the time, one of the biggest stars, it's Superman. Like, this should have been a slam dunk.
Yeah.
it's nuts. I will say, you know, when they first get to finally talking about Nicolas Cage in the movie, they show a lot of clips from old Nicolas Cage movies. And I will say, seeing all those clips of Nicolas Cage movies kind of got me a little nostalgic for this podcast. It's like, wow, what a journey we've been on with Nicolas Cage.
Yeah, you know, the clips, like,
yeah, they're showing clips from, like, Wild at Heart and Adaptation and Birdie and everything. This is cool.
When he's dancing down the aisle and leaving Las Vegas.
Yes.
Like, oh, man.
They show his Oscar speech and everything. Yeah, like, we were so young back then, Mike, when we... when we review those movies. Now, in addition to Cage, I mean, I kind of wanted to briefly bring this up, but they talked about some of the other actors they were looking at for this movie. So for Lois Lane, they wanted Sandra Bullock, apparently.
Right.
Which I think, you know, 98 era Sandra Bullock, like, she actually could have been a great Lois Lane. I'm picturing her from Speed as Lois Lane. Like, that could have been really cool. They were also looking at Courtney Cox and Julianne Moore. And they were saying they actually reached out to Sandra Bullock and she passed on it. So, you know, that's unfortunate. But I mean, the movie didn't end up getting made anyway, so. But Sandra Bullock would have been cool. Apparently, Chris Rock was going to play Jimmy Olsen.
Which would have been awesome.
That could have been really cool. I loved Kevin Smith's anecdote about that, where he's just, where he's talking about he's, like, filming Dogma with Chris Rock at the time, and Chris Rock comes on set, like, guess who just got the call to play Jimmy Olsen? and Kevin Smith's like, you? It's like, yeah, why not me, motherfucker? It's like, yeah, no, that's awesome. I'm surprised. apparently, they'd also talked about either Lex Luthor as Brainiac, Jim Carrey or Christopher Walken were their two choices. Which either one of those would be insane. And I guess Jim Carrey, because he had just come off doing The Riddler and Batman Forever.
Right.
And Christopher Walken, Tim Burton had worked with a couple times on Batman Returns also. And then for Lex Luthor, they actually wanted the guy who would end up playing him in Superman Returns, Kevin Spacey. Which I thought was pretty fascinating, and I think it was interesting to watch this movie that came out 3 years ago, being like, "Yeah, Bryan Singer, Kevin Spacey, they're great guys." But I get it, because I mean, they were huge industry figures at the time. Like, it's weird to look back at that now. And I mean, Kevin Spacey was like he was the obvious choice for Lex Luthor from, like, day one. Like, when he was cast as Lex Luthor in Superman Returns, it was like, yeah, obviously Kevin Spacey's playing Lex Luthor. How could he not? You know,
I thought it was really interesting. The way they kind of talked about Superman Returns and Superman Lives, and the way, like, you know, Bryan Singer apparently had that Polaroid in his binder of Nicolas Cage at the costume test, saying, "We're not making this movie," or whatever. He would threaten the studio executives, like, "You almost made this, and you're going to get mine instead," or whatever.
Which is pretty funny.
Yeah, I think it's pretty funny, but it's just, like, a weird thing that, like, that this movie, it, like, permeated that far. That I was on set, the director on set of this new Superman movie was like, yeah, this is what you almost did, like, as a threat. It's pretty crazy.
Yeah, definitely. And then, yeah, apparently at one point, Brainiac and Lex Luthor would have actually fused bodies and become, like, a two-headed monster. So, like, theoretically, you could have seen, like, Kevin Spacey and, like, Jim Carrey on one on one body, and it would have been insane.
Like, Voldemort before Voldemort.
Yeah, I guess Voldemort before Voldemort, but it, like, the concept design actually had, like, a two-headed monster. Like, it's not just the back of his head. It's,
yeah,
like,
one of them was, but the other one was actually...
Oh, yeah, actually, yeah, you're right. But, yeah, but they even, like, referenced the fact that, like, it was, like, some 50s sci-fi movie or whatever. Called, like, the thing with two heads or something. And they were like, oh, yeah. And I think, and part of what was fascinating to me about this, too, was, like, seeing the influences that they were drawing from for this movie, too. I mean, obviously, they mentioned H.R. Geiger a few times, but, like, you know, Tim Burton starts talking about, like, the classic Universal horror movies, and, like, John Peters is talking about these, like, sci-fi movies that he saw when he was a kid, and that kind of thing. I think they referenced John Carpenter's The Thing at one point. I don't
probably.
I feel like that was thrown in there, but, it's, you know, there's a lot of different influences going into this, and you realize, like, you know, that's how it works for every movie. Like, there's so many different, like, everybody who's working on a movie has their own taste and style and influence, and that all kind of comes together in the final product.
Yeah.
And so I thought it was cool to kind of get, like a breakdown of everybody's, like, what everybody was bringing to the table on this movie.
Yeah. Yeah, that's my favorite part, I think, just sort of, like, overall about this movie is just the, like, how creative a process the pre-production of a movie is.
Because
it's the part you never really hear about, I think. Like, a lot of the behind-the-scenes stuff and is, you know, during the filming and, like, interviews with the actors and stuff like that. No one really, unless it's a very effects-heavy movie, like, you know, The Thing or something like that,
right.
Nobody really gives a shit about the prosthetic guy. but so much of this movie was going to be told through the suit, and, you know, that's, I thought, was really interesting. And the other concept I really liked, too, was, like, this character of Kay. I don't know if that is a character in the comic books, like Superman's, like, robo-teddy bear thing.
I think it was something Tim Burton made up, I think is what they said, actually.
Okay, yeah. Where it was, like, going to be in the rocket ship with the ship with him as an infant, and then it would eventually change and mature with him and help Superman grow, and eventually, like, become his suit and revive him. And I thought that was really cool, and, like, the concepts for it were really awesome. The concept art was really interesting and weird, and I don't know, like, that stuff I wish, like, would have happened.
Yeah, definitely. So I think overall our thoughts are, I think we're pretty positive on this documentary.
Yeah.
Because we're just so fascinated with the story of Superman Lives, and, you know, we've referenced it on this podcast before, but it's good to, like, actually get this, like, I'm glad this movie exists, because it gives you, like, a full, in-depth look on what Superman Lives might have been. It might have been terrible. Like, it's it's definitely possible. There's so much shit going on in this potential movie they were making. You know, it could have been insane, but it could have been amazing. It could have been a really interesting, like, auteur-driven Superman movie. And the kind that, you know, I feel like with superhero movies today, as much as I love the Marvel Universe, as much as I enjoy superhero movies in general, there is definitely, I feel like you can feel a sort of shift where it's like you're getting less and less director-driven superhero movies, and you're getting more and more kind of studio-driven superhero movies, right? And so, like, with Captain Marvel, you had Anna Boden and Ryan Fleck making that movie, and they're talented directors, but, like, it just feels that it felt very, like they didn't really feel like they had, like, a voice over the Marvel overlords that were watching over the movie, I guess.
Yeah.
And that's exactly what, like, I think the Russos are sort of the same way, too. And as much as I like the Russos, I like what they've done with it, they are TV directors who kind of came in, and now they're kind of running the biggest TV show on the face of the planet now, right?
Right. That's a good way to put it. I feel like there's a couple standout directors now.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you get your James Gunn, who, by the way, we haven't mentioned in this film bookcast yet, but he's back in Guardians 3, which is wild.
That's crazy. Stay tuned.
So we'll talk about that on the next episode. But, yeah, James Gunn, I think, is a very talented and, like, distinctive director. I think Joss Whedon, when he was doing it, same deal. Take away T.T. and Thor Ragnarok. Ryan Coogler and Black Panther. Like, there is definitely directors who have their distinctive voices, but I think there's more examples of that not necessarily being the case. And a lot of those movies that even aren't are still enjoyable. You know, I'm still, like,
absolutely.
I still enjoy my Ant-Man and the Wasps and whatever, but it's just, but it just feels like, you know, you're seeing more and more of these kind of studio driven movies and less of these, like, weird auteuristic visions, in blockbuster films, which has always been the case. It's very difficult for an auteur driven blockbuster film to be made in the first place. But Superman Lives could have been that, and I mean, that's a perfect example of how tough it is to get that out there.
Yeah, see the last 50 minutes.
Yeah.
see why that doesn't happen sometimes.
Exactly. So any final thoughts on The Death of Superman Lives? What happened, Mike?
No, I think people should check it out. If you are interested in this story, or this kind of story about this, like, this pre-production phase of movies, or specifically, you know, Nicolas Cage or this movie in particular, the story of what happened, check it out on YouTube. It's free. It's an hour and 40 minutes. Yeah. Like, give it a shot.
Yeah, it's an easy watch, and yeah, it's free on YouTube right now, so that's pretty awesome. And I would recommend, I mean, if you're interested in, like, the making of pre-production stuff, Jodorowsky's Dune, also a very good documentary. About the making of Alejandro Jodorowsky's version of Dune, which never got to screen, and also Lost in La Mancha, which is about the filmmaking process, not the pre-production, but that's a pretty insane documentary too. But yeah, Death Superman Lives. I was a fan, just really enjoyed the movie, and it's worth checking out. And I think we can move on to some Letterboxd reviews, Mike.
Yes.
So let's do that. Here's a 3.5-star Letterboxd review from for Death Superman Lives. What happened? That goes. Seeing Nicolas Cage in that costume with the mullet wig was a sight to see, and made me wish this film had been made. Make no mistake, it would have been a goddamn disaster of monumental proportions. keep in mind, Tim Burton made Planet of the Apes just a few years later. but it would have been a memorable disaster. One last thing. As they talk about everything they were going to put in the film, the giant spider, Lex Luthor, Brainiac, the skull ship with the monsters, the ninja fight, the death and return of Superman, and Lord knows what else, it made me wonder... Was Superman Lives going to have a 5-hour runtime? Which is a fair question. I mean, there's a lot of stuff going on in Superman Lives, and I'm sure some of that was from like other drafts that didn't make it into certain drafts or whatever. But like, there's a lot of ground that this movie covered.
Yeah, that's definitely one of the things they don't quite. I mean, not that I don't think you really need it, but like the difference between the three different drafts that kind of are like the versions of this movie,
right?
Because if you total them all together, it's way too much insanity. Like, there's, I can't keep track of it. So it's hard to be sure which one was which and what had what version and all this stuff. But yeah, it's bonkers.
It is bonkers. Here's another review from Letterboxd with no star rating. I am certain that Tim Burton's 90s Nick Cage Superman movie would not only have been the best Superman movie ever, but it would have saved humanity from a depressed / self-doubting / burned out Burton death spiral. of some half-hearted aesthetic decisions later in his career. For the record, I adore Sleepy Hollow, Sweeney Todd, and the full-length Frankenweenie. The suits were awesome. Spacey Luther is right on. But Spider Brainiac walking in a flying skull? Sign me up. Not to mention Nicolas Cage as disaffected geek Clark Kent and lonely planet boy Superman? Heck yes. here's a 3-star review of That Superman Lives. Goes, I don't know what it says that the only people here that seem like they were genuinely excited to make a Superman movie are noted lunatics like Cage or John Peters and then Kevin Smith.
That's pretty funny.
Here's a 1-star review of Death Superman Lives that goes, all the same problems and perks of documentaries of this nature, i.e. Jodorowsky's Dune, an hour and a half slideshow of cool concept art sprinkled with moderately fun anecdotes and wishful what-if optimism. Things take from this. John Peters is pure Nutter Butters. Tim Burton doesn't know what to do with his hands.
Yep.
Apparently, if you make a documentary on a film that never happened, you have to mention Geiger and Mobius 500 times. which is a pretty good slam.
That's good.
Concept art is always better than the final product. And Dan Gilroy yells in every sentence.
I did notice that.
Which I did notice that, too. That was really weird. Just he was talking at a volume that was, like, very much higher than everyone else.
Yeah.
Here's a 4-star review from Letterboxd that goes, so Tim Burton's Superman Lives. Everyone knows this never-made 1998 movie would have sucked ass. Now, if it came out and bombed, would X-Men still have come out a couple years later? Would Spider-Man still have been made a couple years after that? Would we still even have the superhero genre we have today? What the fuck happened, indeed? So, this isn't the most polished documentary ever made, but once you get past the amateurish moments and the wild story of this weird, aborted blockbuster begins to unfold, it quickly becomes compelling. While Tim Burton's take on it all is fascinating, and the raw footage of endless Cage costume tests are gold, the real freak show star of this thing is producer John Peters. Did you know he claims to be a street fighter? has tasted another man's blood? He's, quote, not a good reader?
Yeah.
And has scripts read to him, and he doesn't seem to like Kevin Smith at all. Along with all that, we hear from countless artists, writers, and effects guys that all spent years and years on this thing, speaking honestly on how Superman Lives may not have been a good movie and was killed by the same super-budget, shallow movies it was becoming. For fans of development hell stories, superhero movies, or how movies get made in general, this rough around the edges doc can be a really fascinating watch. And now, finally, one last one, a 3.5-star review of Death of Superman Lives that goes, well, at least they didn't cancel Wild Wild West. and I think we can be grateful for that one, Mike.
Yeah. Yeah. He got the Thanagarian Snare Beast. He finally got it.
He got that giant spider. I'm happy for him. all right, Mike. That about wraps up our thoughts on Death of Superman Lives, what happened. Where can we find you online this week?
You can find me at MDFilmBlog on Twitter.
And you can find me at MSmithFilmBlog on Twitter, all of our podcasts and stuff at filmbook.com. And thank you for listening to The Complete Works. I'm Mike Smith. That's Mike DiCriscio. If you're listening on iTunes, or even if you're not, make sure to rate and review us. 5 stars would be great. And tell people you know about the show if you can. If you want to contact us, you can do so by emailing nicholascagecompleteworks@gmail.com. We would love to hear from you. Join us for the next Complete Works, where we'll be getting back to movies that actually star Nicolas Cage.
what a twist.
What a novel concept, right? A 2015 political thriller called The Runner. So we'll see how that goes. Plus, keep an eye out for Film Bookcast, where we'll be talking the new horror movie from Jordan Peele, Us. And Mike, you're so excited about Us that you've bought tickets to see it twice already, right?
Yeah, by accident. But yeah, definitely by accident. Worth it.
Yes, I think it's going to be really cool. So we'll be seeing that this weekend and reviewing it next week. And we'll definitely weigh in on that James Gunn news as well, because that's insane. Thanks so much for listening, guys, and thanks for getting in the cage.
Nick Cage, motherfucker! Think about that while you're leaving Las Vegas! Boom. Nick Cage, motherfucker! Boom. Nick Cage, motherfucker!